Hey, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming to this session. Really appreciate your time. Hopefully, we'll make it worth your while here. So today, we are going to talk about schema evolution in Apache Hive at scale. And this will be a talk very from a printless data engineering perspective. So the issues that we saw when it comes to like schema evolution in general, and specifically for Apache Hive, how we solved it, the problems with our solution, and then how we went on with solving that. So a bunch of like good technical discussion coming up. But before that, let's start with the most important thing, and that's about me. So I'm Ashish Singh, work on the big data platform team at Pinterest. I've been there for like a couple of years. Prior to that, I was with Cloudera, working mostly on a bunch of like different Apache projects, including Kafka, Hive, Parquet, Sentry. I've been a contributor and a committer on Apache Software Foundation. So that's one of the reasons why I'm here. Really love the ASF, how it builds a community. All right. So moving on. I'm sure you all are aware of Pinterest, but if you are not, it's the world's catalog of ideas. Before joining Pinterest, even I didn't use Pinterest. But after I joined it, I started using it because I was building it. And I got super interested. Like just after this conference, I have a Hawaii vacation coming up, and I'm planning that on Pinterest. It's super interesting how you can find and learn from experiences of other people and you can explore. Not a marketing person, not selling you guys on that, just telling you my perspective. And by the way, we are hiring in case you guys are interested. All right, so a little bit of numbers on the scale of Pinterest. We recently announced this, the business scale. We crossed 250 million monthly active users, a huge milestone for us. Just a year back, we were at 200 million monthly active users. We have over 175 billion pins. I'm sure like you are more interested in the data side, so we have some numbers on the data scale too. Our data is like over 250 petabytes, and all of this is on S3. So usually, the more data you have, the more understanding you have on your business and your users, the way they are interacting with your product, that helps you shape the future of the company. However, because we have all this data on S3, it comes at a huge cost. So we are constantly trying to evaluate like how do we keep the cost low and still have like much more meaningful data set. We have over 7,000 Hive and Hadoop nodes, over 400 Presto nodes, and these numbers are growing like every day. We want to keep them as low as possible, but they are growing. Everything is on cloud. We are primarily an AWS shop. All our data is on S3. All our processing instances are on EC2 instances. So we don't have a single machine on-prem. Everything is on cloud. So this is just a brief overview, a very high-level view of the data pipeline at Pinterest. It will be very similar to what other companies have. So we have a thing called Singer, which is, in layman terms, it's a Kafka producer, right? And it runs on all the fleet that we have, whether it's a client, whether it's a instance on a part of our web fleet. Anything that runs and consumes processing power on AWS and is built to Pinterest has a single client running. And the single client basically enables like people to not write like Kafka producer. What it enables is like they just tell that, okay, I'm going to log to this particular file on local disk and configure the Kafka topic where this data should be logged to, and that's it. And single takes care of like making sure it's at least once, sometimes even exactly once. So it provides, abstracts out all those complex pieces of the Kafka producer and makes it very easy. Like as soon as you log to a file, it will be present on Kafka. So everything goes to flows into Kafka. So Singer is one of the points where, actually the majority point where the data comes in to Kafka from. But we also have like CDC capture going through Kafka too, change data capture, incremental MySQL DB ingestion. That project is called Watermill. It also flows through Kafka. So once we have data in Kafka, there are two major points where this data is consumed from. depending on the nature of the use case. Like whether it's, if it is streaming, it's very likely to be getting consumed from Kafka directly. If it is batch, we typically throw Kafka data into S3, do some sanitization and stuff over it, and then like batch systems access the data from S3 directly. And the Merced is also an open source project from us. It takes care of making sure that you are like putting all your Kafka data into S3. Right, so then we have the processing systems, like streaming system. We have Spark streaming primarily and a little bit of Kafka streaming for now. Then we have batch systems such as like MapReduce, Spark, cascading, scaling, a bunch of those things. And then for the ad hoc querying experience, we primarily have Presto and Hive, for Hive Server 2. And on top of these processing systems, we have a bunch of like data products enabling users to analyze, look at the general trend and stuff like that. All right, so this is a short agenda for today. So far we talked about the overall data pipeline. I'll be talking a little bit about the data processing aspect of that pipeline, and that will enable us to understand why schemas are important. And because schemas are important, schema evolution becomes a problem, and we'll talk about why is that important? How do we solve this schema evolution problem at Pinterest and the benefits of solving that we have seen? And then we'll jump into some question and answer session. All right. So the data processing overview, there are a lot of components on it, but the things I want you to focus on is these two blocks. So this block is basically a workflow scheduling system. You can think of it as Airflow, which is much more popular than this. But like even Pinball, and Pinball is open source. We have like other, there are at least a couple of other companies which are using Pinball. And then, there's two pieces involved here. One is like you have a scheduled jobs or queries running, right? The other piece is like when you have ad hoc queries or jobs running. So for scheduled jobs and queries, we have like, if it is directly a MapReduce or Spark job, it directly goes to the Yarn or Mesos cluster. But if it is a scheduled query, we only support Hive right now. And that goes through a very interesting pipeline, which I'll be talking about in the next couple of slides. But if it is an ad hoc query, you have option of Presto or Hive Server 2. And like all the data is on AWS S3. As similar to what we talked about in the previous slides. Diving a little bit deeper into Hive, so we have two ways of running Hive queries. One is like ad hoc, the other one is scheduled. Ad hoc is like pretty standard. You have Hive Server 2 where you submit your queries, like which then create MapReduce applications on Yarn or Mesos cluster. Has a Metastore, which is fronting a MySQL DB. Pretty standard. However, on the scheduled query, because we have tens of thousands of queries running daily, and these queries are accessing lots of data, and these are like production queries. We want them to be scalable. We want them to be very reliable. And more importantly, we don't want like failure of one query affecting other queries. To that, like some people would say even Hive Server 2 can handle that, but in our experience, it hasn't been able to do that. For example, one of the issues we have seen is like Hive lets you add a bunch of random jars, right? So you can do add jar statement, and then like it loads that jar in your class path. Now, if you load some crazy jar which like cause a kernel panic, it actually brings down the whole Hive Server 2 instance, and that kills all the queries running at that particular instant of time. So though we can survive that kind of instances on ad hoc querying, because like on ad hoc query we say that okay, you try your query. We try our best to make it work. If it doesn't work, you retry your query. But on prod, we can't do that. Like, we have strict SLAs on the prod. I'm sure you all have a similar kind of SLAs for predictions. So for a scheduled query, we actually have some a pipeline where what we do is we run the Hive queries itself as a Yarn application. So what happens is that, like, say you have a query that you want to run in production. So we take that query. We go to resource manager, we say that, hey, give me a container. And this, we do this via the distributed shell application. So why does it like it goes to the resource manager, gets a container for application master, which is a distributed shell application master. And then like it gets a worker, which is again a container. And in that worker, it runs a shell And in that shell, it runs a Hive CLI. And because you're running Hive CLI into that, you are basically, you can be assured that like no other Hive queries running in the system is going to affect it. It's within a container. And also, because you can scale out the Yarn cluster pretty much, you can scale up or down, scale out the capabilities of running concurrent queries that are in the cluster based on your use cases or time of the year. Like in holidays, we generally scale it out. So to be able to make that work, we actually talk to the name nodes, node managers, REST APIs to get the STD out and STD error and process the data from there. So all the results will be on STD out, all the logs and everything is on STD error. So we get that. We have a REST endpoint that we provide this information from. All right, on the Presto side, so this figure is actually from the Presto overview documentation, so nothing special there. In our case, instead of having Presto CLI, we have like a bunch of REST endpoint that we expose to our clients. And so these clients are actually using PyHive, which is a open source project from Dropbox. But we have a wrapper on top of it, which does some cool stuff. I won't be talking about that in this talk. The other change that we have is like instead of talking to S3FS, all the Presto workers talk to S3 because all our data is on S3. Now, so far, we talked about two ways of accessing data, right? So you can process data to get information, or the way I put it is like you can ask questions to your data using two ways. One is programmatic access and the SQL access. For programmatic access at Pinterest, we have like MapReduce, Spark, Cascading, Scarding for now. And then for SQL, we have Hive, Presto, and Spark SQL. So far we have been talking about the processing of data, right? And this brings us to schemas, right? Because to understand the data, or to read or write the data, we need to know what that data represents. And for that, we need schemas. Whether the schema is part of the data itself, or in other terms, data is self-describing, that's fine too. But like we need some schema to understand the data. And that's where schemas is basically shape of data defines how to understand the data. Or you can say like it's a contract that readers, writers can access the data or rewrite the data using the schemas. The other advantage of schemas is that like when you have a well-defined schema, you will be able to identify malformed data or like some data corruption issues. I'm sure you guys have heard of schemaless data, but we won't be going there. And I think the schemas data is no data, because even if like you say schemaless data, what people meant is they have a very generic or very liberal schema. So they will have a key value pair, and the key will define the schema. It's very hard to have no schema for data and still be able to rewrite the data or understand the data. All right, so once we have the schemas, once we understand that like schemas are important to rewrite data, the next question is the changing part of the schema. Remember, we talked about the programmatic access and SQL access at Pinterest. For programmatic access, the schemas that we use are mostly thrift schemas. So we have a thrift schema repo where all the schemas live. And like all the programmatic access, like all the code that goes and gets the schemas from the thrift schema repo. And whenever I say thrift schema repo, I actually mean the artifacts from thrift schema repo. It's not actually talking to a Git repo or something. For the SQL access, Hive, Presto, Spark SQL, they all talk to the Hive MetaStore, which is pretty much a standard for using storing and accessing schemas for SQL access on big data. So because I'll be referring to this in the later slides, for programmatic access, we have thrift schema repo. For SQL access, we have Hive MetaStore. Now, coming back to the schema problem, schema evolution is what we'll be talking about today. And like if you search schema evolution on Google, this is the first hit you will get. It basically says that schema evolution deals with the need to retain current data and software system functionality in the face of changing database structure. What it basically means is that schema evolution means that you should be able to change the schemas without breaking your systems or your clients. Now, why do we even need schema evolution, right? Sometimes, most of the times, your use cases evolve, and so the data evolves, and so the schema changes. But some of the times, like maybe you forgot to add a schema or a column in the first when you were creating the schema, and then you later on realize that, okay, there has to be this new column, and then you go ahead and add it. The third, I think, like a major reason of schema change is the collaboration, right? Like, so it's very common these days that like you have like a bunch of different teams taking care of like one aspect of the data, right? So say like you have a team for user registry, right? Like, and then user registry team decided that, okay, now they are going to store mother's maiden name as part of the registry. Now, because like your schemas or like your data was dependent on that user schema registry, you are inherently getting the change reflected in your system. So if you're not able to evolve the schema of your system, that can cause breakage. Now let's talk about the schema evolution in terms of Hive and Presto. As you said, like Hive, Presto, they both use Metastore. And Metastore, everything is stable. So you can create a table, you can, and Metastore allows you to like modify the table schemas using alter table statements. One thing to note here, though, is if you do alter table statement, it basically what Hive does is like it will apply that change for the new partitions. It won't do it for the old partitions. So many a times, like for us, it was a case where users would use the alter table statement, run their queries, and come to us and say that, hey, you know what? Like we changed the schema, but we are not seeing the new data, even though we backfilled the older partitions. That's because like by default, Hive doesn't cascade the change to older partitions. You have to explicitly say cascade this change to older partitions. And that's an option in the alter table statement. All right. So in this scenario, when we are relying mostly on the Hive Metastore, let's try to understand what are the problems with the Hive Metastore when it comes to schema evolution. So the first problem is it doesn't go through code review or like peer review. So anyone can change these schemas. Like, sure, you can have tools, you can have audit tools, you can have access control tools to make sure no one, like only a limited set of people can do it. But then like you hit the scalability problem for a high growth environment. The second issue is that the schema changes can require changes to too many tables. Like if a very common schema changed and it's used by a bunch of different tables, then that will require you to go ahead and change all those tables. In database world, we always say that you should never duplicate the data or duplicate the columns into like separate tables because of this reason. But for performance reasons, like many times we choose to do that, which is not a bad idea, to avoid the joins between like a bunch of different tables. And when this happens, there will be a period of time where your different tables can be out of sync because you are like upgrading schemas on one table while there are like 10 other tables in your pipeline which are waiting on to update the schema. The other problem is it's very hard to maintain the schema versioning. So if you change the schema, you can't really, sure, like you can build the tools on top of it, but like it's very hard to maintain like and go back and see, okay, what was the previous schema and all that. And also there's no way you can say that, okay, I'm changing the schema for this particular reason. It's very hard to like audit the changes and stuff. Again, like all of these are solvable by building tools on top of it. By default, Hive out of box doesn't provide you any such thing. The other aspect is that your alter table statement itself is limited by the query length. And depending on the use cases, like for us, some of our tables have like over 50,000 columns. Not an ideal scenario, but we have that. And in those cases, like it's very hard to run the alter table statements because like the query will fail just because of the query text length. And just to show like how critical tables are for Pinterest, like this is a graph showing like how the number of tables has been growing at Pinterest over the past 1 year. It has been growing pretty linearly. In the past year, we have seen 40% growth, and there's no reason for us to anticipate like this growth will slow down in the coming years. And that's why like having a solution for schemas is very important for us. I'm sure like for others too. Like having a very static schema defined in Metastore makes it very brittle for the system for the schemas to evolve in your pipeline. Notice that we have two places where we are maintaining schemas now: Hive Metastore, and then we have a thrift schema repository. So many a times, changes to one will have to be reflected to the other one. And even more so on Metastore side, you have to do that for multiple tables. So it becomes like very cumbersome, and the system is like very brittle and easy to break in those scenarios. So remember this thing that we are saying, we have mostly Thib schema repo accessible by programmatic access, and then we have SQL access accessing Metastore. So we made change so that like Metastore only holds a pointer to the Thib schema repo. We don't use Metastore to hold the columns statically. It just holds a pointer of the Thib class that we should be using to read data. And so now all your, whether it is like SQL access or like a programmatic access, everyone can now talk to Thib schema repo to get the schemas to read the data. So irrespective of whether you read it from Hive or Presto or your MapReduce, Spark, wherever you read it from, you have just one schema defined in one repo, that's it. So that made it very easy for us to like evolve over the period of time. The schemas were changed, were well audited, were peer reviewed. They have like all the logs of like why was a change made. So that made us like very easy for us to evolve and collaborate among like various teams that we have. Now the question comes is like, sure, we use Thib schema repo, but like, how do we use it, right? Like, and typically Hive, basically, you say that okay, I'm going to read the table schema from the Metastore. So we do that, but for us, like, we bypass the, or we only get the Thib class name from the Metastore, and then like construct a Thib object based on that class in Hive driver itself. The way we enable that is via SERDE. So Hive SERDE, the SERDE in this case, it stands for serializer deserializer. So in this figure, like we are talking about how Hive actually reads data. So the first figure is the read path. Once you have the data on disk, right, it's in either like text file or sequence file format, Hive specifies that, okay, I'm going to read these files with this input file format, which you have to define based on the data that you have. Like if it is text, you specify text input file format. If it is sequence file, you specify sequence file input format. So based on that, like that, those input formats knows how to read those files. Once it reads those files, it converts them into a key value pair. In Hive, they basically create a writable object. Key here is irrelevant. The value is the content that we care about. Once we have the value writable in memory, that's when deserializer comes in and says that, okay, so we have this value, which could be a byte stream or just like a byte array, and then we have to somehow make sense out of it. Like that's where schema comes in. And this is the part where we use the Thib class to construct, basically convert the writable into a Thib object. And after that, like once you have the Thib object, we convert that to Hive struct, which is what Hive is capable of understanding or pushing down their operators on. So after that point, Hive is very much able to operate on those Hive structs. On the write path, what Hive does is once it has the row object in the memory, it serializes that again to a key value pair, and then you specify the output file format, which specifies whether it's text or sequence file, and that's what it writes into files on disk. Okay, so I basically talked about this already, but this is the read path for the Thib SERDE that we use that enables us to read data without actually accessing columns from Metastore, but directly from Thib class. So we specify input file format depending on the format of the data itself. And then that data is then read into a writable, which is a key value pair here. And then deserializer comes in, which basically converts the writable into the to row object, which is a Thib object here. And then we have the object inspector, which is capable of converting that Thib object into Hive struct, which Hive understands. All right, so far we have talked about how we enabled Hive to use Thib schemas to read data from disk, right? But we haven't yet answered the question of like how does the thrift changes actually propagate to the system? Because like the thrift changes can happen at any point of time. Does it require deploying to all the instances? Does it deploying us to? Does it require for us to restart the Hive server to every time we make the schema changes? Actually, not. So this is how the schema changes propagate. User comes in, they make changes to the schema, makes a git commit. We have a Jenkins to build the artifacts out of it. And once we have the artifacts ready, it's pushed to a S3 bucket. And that's where Hive pulls these artifacts from. So Hive has this concept of Hive RC. So Hive RC is basically a bunch of SQL statements that it runs before session is started. So during whenever a Hive session starts, one of the things it does is like it will pull these artifacts from S3 and add it to the Hive's class path. And after that, like lookup of thrift schema classes using reflection, we are able to find those. So these schemas are as latest as like when you actually created a Hive session, which is like when you actually start running query. So this is how users use it for now. We have this thrift study class. And we have a bunch of different variants of this. So thrift study is again like what we just already talked about, and then like we have different variants of it. And then the way it knows which class to load, which thrift type to use for a particular table is via a study property. We just call it thrift type, and you specify the class that it should be using. So this statement basically is saying that any data that this table has is stored at this location and can be read using this thrift type. So how often do we actually use this solution? We roughly have had made like 14,000 schema changes so far, which is like 3,000 changes a year. So we do change these schemas very frequently. And like more than 5,000 tables, and these are like very frequently used tables, very business critical tables that uses the solution. So far, it has been working very well for us. However, as we grow, we have other problems to solve. So one of the problems that we started running into is the amount of data kept increasing, the amount of partitions kept increasing, and then we started hitting like S3 slowdowns. And in general, the jobs started slowing down because like we have too much of data to process. And S3 can be substantially slow, especially like if you have uncompressed data because everything goes over the network anyway. So that's the first challenge. And the second challenge that we started seeing is that we couldn't use any columnar storage like Parquet or OASI with thrift schemas because like Parquet stores its schema along with data, right? So how do you align thrift schema evolution, which has like its own set of rules for schema evolution, with Parquet schema evolution? Making them work together became challenging. So that was the next challenge we took on, which was basically enabling folks to use thrift schemas but write data in Parquet. Doing that would enable us to drastically reduce the amount of reads that we do, which boils down to less I/O weight because we are pulling in less data, less GC because we are only pulling in relevant data, and so we are not pulling any data which we don't need, and so it needs to be garbage collected the moment it comes in, and which basically means like we are efficiently utilizing the resources, which means that higher cluster throughput, which is all we care about. However, to get there, these were the few challenges that we saw. So Parquet Thrift wasn't really compatible. Even now, it's not compatible with Hive Parquet Write support. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. And then the problem of reading the nested columns, like how do you read nested columns, especially when like you have a thrift schema. And for us, these thrift schemas can be very deeply nested. As I said, like we have some cases where we have like 50,000 columns in a table, and these are like not linear columns; they are like very deeply nested. And it's very easy to do that without knowing in Thrift, because you can use a random class in a class, Thrift class, and which can be used further on. So you kept adding on that lineage without even knowing that you're building a very nested Thrift schema. The next problem was that, like, once you have this Parquet data and you want to construct Thrift objects out of it, how do you really solve the problem of not reading all the columns? Because if you're reading all the columns, you're not gaining any performance. It's only when, like, you're reading a few columns, that's when you're reducing the reads. So how do we solve that problem? Especially when, because in Thrift, like in schemas, you can define certain fields as required. And these fields are required for you to construct a Thrift object. So for example, say in user registry, you have first name and last name as required for a user, right? But in your SQL query, all you care about is the first name. You don't care about the last name. So is it possible to construct Thrift objects without reading last names from Parquet data? And the last, how do you evolve your, or basically how you align the Thrift schema evolution with Parquet schema evolution? So these were the challenges that we started facing when we tried to make Parquet work along with Thrift schemas. So the first problem, Parquet Thrift compatibility with high Parquet write support. So that was a problem mostly because Parquet Thrift module of the Parquet MR project wasn't getting enough love. This was a not so well maintained part of the project. So in all other object models of Parquet, there's already support for writing three-level structure, but Parquet Thrift did not have this capability. Hive Parquet write support actually uses that three-level list write capability, because while reading, it only understands the three-level list structure. So we worked on this. It's there if people want to use it. So that was the first problem that we saw and we solved. The second problem was the reading nested columns, but that's one of the advantages of using an Apache project, is that, like, you get not all of the problems is not what you need to solve, because, like, some of the problems are already solved for you. So Hive 15 or 5.5 already solved that problem for us. It was solved in Hive 2.x or something, but we are on Hive 1.2, pretty old version, so we had to backport it. But this does solve the problem of nested fields. It was very important for us because, like, as I said, like, we have a lot of nested columns, especially in the Thrift schemas. So once we had this change, all we had to is, like, how do we align the Thrift schemas and the column projection capability of Parquet? The next challenges, which was, like, how not to read all the columns while to construct a Thrift object, solved all of these problems by deciding not to construct a Thrift object. So to understand how can we get by without constructing a Thrift object while reading, let's understand. Let's start with, like, how do we actually write the data? So we have a row object. We serialize that into a Thrift object, and then we write it to Parquet, right? So and for this, like, we have customized output format that we use. But one of the things that we do as part of it is, like, we write the, as I said, like, before, Parquet maintains its own schema, and it's stored with the data. So at this point, what we do is, like, we actually store the Thrift schema conversion into a Parquet schema, a compatible Parquet schema, and that is stored with the data. So now we have data and schema together, and it's the schema is, like, the Thrift-compatible version. Now, when you read it, all we do is, like, we read the standard way. We don't use Thrift class there at all. So we use the existing mapped Parquet input format, which is what Hive comes with by default. You read it into key value and deserialize into Hive struct, which works just fine, because there's no reason for you to use Thrift object after you have Hive struct constructed. The reason you in other methods, the reason you need a Thrift object is because, like, you want to construct Hive struct out of it. But in this case, we directly construct the high struct, and so we just like go around the problem of how do we have the thrift and parquet schema evolution problem sorted out. This is how users use this. Pretty similar to the previous version. Users specify a survey. This is a different survey, which takes care of writing data as parquet. Again, like users specify, there's a typo. There's no stored as sequence file. It's storing as parquet. You specify the thrift type, which is what is then converted into a parquet schema. The input format is the standard input format. We don't have any customization for that. For output format, we have a custom output format that basically does the thrift object to parquet conversion using the thrift schema from the schema repo. Just to give an idea of like the advantages of that we saw using parquet file format is that so one of the very popular tables that we have, we had a sequence file version, the parquet version, and both were using a thrift class from our thrift schema repo. And with our solution, we were able to, and the parquet file format, we were able to read 99.7% less data compared to the sequence file version, which is like tremendous because, as I said, like less data read, low GC, better cluster throughput. That was all. I see that you guys were very mesmerized by it. So I'm open for questions. So I'll be happy to, like if you have questions about the solution or like data engineering at Pinterest, I'll be happy to take questions.
So in one QRS that you mentioned, 14K schema changes.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah. So that's the advantage of schema evolution. One more thing I forgot to mention is that like whenever we do the schema changes, and because it's part of the schema repo, they have like a bunch of unit tests that goes through and make sure that you're able to read the old data too. So every schema change goes with some amount of data that is like belongs to the older version, and then some amount of data which is like will confirm to the new version, and then like you have automated tests which run with like run. Like a MapReduce job or a Hive query that will make sure that like you're not breaking the older versions too. So that's the advantage of using one schema repo is that like you just do the DevOps, make sure the unit test and everything works on one repo and then like you just keep on adding there. Yeah. So, because in Hive, the schemas are defined at the partition level. So when you actually read data, you are reading by the schemas that are defined for that partition. So if you have old data, you have schema defined for that partition, which was correct then when the data was written, right? But in some cases, we backfill the data with a new schema, and then we cascade the changes to the older partition too. In our solution, one more good thing is that because you are reading the schema directly from the schema that is stored with the data itself, you're always guaranteed that you'll be able to read that. But there are corner cases where you will run into the issues where like you actually change the data, but like you're using the old schema and then it will fail. But there's always a solution around that. Right.
Schema changes, then there's a like window that you still query the old data.
Right.
It's complex, right?
Right. Yeah, so for us, we haven't seen much of an issue there because, as I said, like the schemas are defined at the partition level. So once you write a partition, the schema is like stored with the partition. And like when you change the schema and then you write data, only for that new data you'll have the new schema defined. So the old data, it still has the older partitions. Older schemas. We, like any other startup, when we started using EMR, but like that could not grow with the, like as we grew. So right now we are like completely in-house. I'm sure you can do that because, actually I'm not sure. I haven't used EMR myself. Like this was before my time at Printers when they used EMR. I don't have an answer to that. But,
who are the primary users of the system? Like who writes queries? Like data scientists?
Yeah. So we have a very wide spectrum of users. Like we have, as I said, like data analysts, data scientists who can only talk to data in terms of SQL. But also we have like very experienced engineers who are writing queries, which basically is a production workflow. So we have a very wide spectrum of users. All right. That's good. Thank you.